in faith, there's a lot of fans.
Yeah.
Right? Just to be honest, like, you know, Jesus has a lot of followers. They're a very passionate fan group. And so they came to us and said, look, we think churches are struggling.
I'm Scott McGrew. Welcome to Sand Hill Road.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
This week, Mike Jones. He's the founder of studio and venture firm Science Inc. and an investor in that blockbuster Liquid Death, Dollar Shave Club, and even a prayer app. Jones, who reminds me quite a bit in person of the actor Ryan Reynolds, was also, for a time, the CEO of MySpace. Did I read somewhere that you have, your firm has $1 billion in exits?
We do. Well, you know, our firm co-founds companies. And yeah. So we've been fortunate that we co-founded Dollar Shave Club, and that was $1 billion exit. And then we co-founded Dog Vacay that became Rover, and that was a $2.4 billion exit. So we've got a bunch of exits under our belts for sure.
Dog Vacay, I want to, it's later in my notes, but I just want to jump right to it.
Sure.
It seems like an idea that, I don't know, that Tom Sawyer would come up with. Yeah. Or something, you know, like sharing the dog walking and dog sitting.
Yeah.
How is that a multi-million dollar business?
You know, it's funny. I think when I was first pitched that too, I had deep skepticism, and it was at the same time that Airbnb was really becoming a mainstream opportunity for everyone. And I think I also didn't fully believe Airbnb was going to work, but turns out, as you'd imagine, there's a lot of people with dogs and they kind of hate kennels and they often have challenges finding a place to have their dog spend the night. And one of the interesting takeaways for us was that the person that happens to love dogs and loves to babysit your dog, that's an overall better experience for you and your dog than a kennel. Because the people that worked at kennels, typically we didn't find that they loved dogs. You know, they worked there.
They got a job at a kennel.
They got a job. They were there for a job, right? Whereas the people that chose to become, you know, service providers on Dog Vacay, they loved pets, and so they did it for passion. So the experience was better.
One of the most fascinating to me is Liquid Death.
Mm-hmm.
Explain to somebody who has never heard of Liquid Death what Liquid Death is.
Well, Liquid Death's many things to many people, but you know, one way to think about it is it was the world's first canned water business. So one of the mission points was to remove plastic from our environment. So they started as a canned water company. They expanded now into flavored sparkling waters and iced teas, and they have a kind of growing product line. But at the end of the day, they want to provide a really healthy beverage, which was canned water, and in our case, low sugar kind of, you know, alternatives to soda, and a really environmental package, which happens to be aluminum cans, with a really cool brand, which is Liquid Death.
Which I think to all of us is the main part about it.
Yeah, right? That's right.
Is that the first time you see it, you think, what are you drinking?
That's right. And that kind of social interaction of what are you drinking? And can I have some of that? And I want to try that.
It's water.
It's water. It's crazy, right? And it makes you feel cooler. But many beverages are kind of set up that way. I think it did surprise me. I thought, you know, originally we anticipated it was going to be fallen in love with by this like death metal, you know, punk rock skateboard crew. But it ended up being, you know, a standard person that walked into Whole Foods suddenly was like really excited about the brand. And so we found it had really broad appeal, even though it started with obviously a really niche, you know, audience.
And I've heard that also it for those who choose not to drink for one reason or another, it kind of gives them something cool to hold.
That's right. I mean, when they pitched me, it happened to be during the Woolsey fire down in Malibu, and I was at a concert we had helped co-arrange with the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and I don't drink alcohol, and they're with my kids, and I'm holding this, like, you know, plastic bottle of water, some Aquafina or something, and I felt kind of lame, like, you know. Yeah. And the next day, they're like, you know, when you go to a concert, if you don't want to hold a beer, you're holding this plastic sparkless bottle, this packed plastic Kirkland bottle of water, and you feel really stupid. Wouldn't it be way cooler if you were holding this? And I was like, gosh, you know, I totally relate to that. It would be cooler.
And young people, I mean, the statistics, they are drinking less. The wine industry is particularly concerned, you know, that the wine, because we're in Northern California.
Yeah.
The average age of a wine user just goes up and up. And we think of young people, when I was young, of being drinkers, and they're not necessarily.
It feels like there's a good health movement kind of broadly happening. There's certainly the legalization of weed across many states that kind of maybe is an alternative to alcohol. But it's funny, I was just back in Bentonville last week meeting with Walmart, and they seem to be selling a lot of alcohol. And, you know, it's like, in these little West Coast liberal bubbles, oh, everyone's drinking less alcohol. I'm not sure. I think maybe within our community, they're drinking less alcohol and they're using mushrooms or psilocybin or they're doing other products. But I'm not sure if the average American is. So I'm really curious if that statistics hold. But trust me, I talk about that a lot because you're right. I fundamentally do believe Gen Z is drinking less alcohol, but I have a feeling America might be buying more despite that.
Interesting.
It's possible.
Liquid Death, most of its success is the brand, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's water.
It's water.
Can it be replaced by somebody else who also comes up with a smart ass label?
A cool brand?
Right. Yeah. Or has that been done?
Well, I think beverages in general are flavored water. Right.
All beverages.
In a certain sense, all beverages. I mean, maybe you love the taste of Red Bull, maybe you don't, but you definitely like the brand, right? The brand of Red Bull is really, really impressive.
I don't think anybody likes the taste of
Red Bull. It's a difficult taste, right? So, you know, I think that in consumer products, you know, there's a lot of co-manufacturing. There's really easy to make a lot of stuff, just to be candid, right? With the defensibility and the long-term growth is that brand positioning. And so that brand has to stay relevant for people to love it. And if they don't, they won't buy it. Because you're right, there's a lot of ways to drink water. Now, it happens to be, I think, we'll sell a lot of iced tea as well.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. Yeah. I mean, you're on the board, right?
I am, yeah.
So when somebody said, hey, you know, maybe we should move into iced tea, I don't know, maybe stick to your knitting. What is, you know, Liquid Death is water.
Yeah, there was quite a few people that did, I think, tell Mike Cesario, the CEO, that he should just stick to water. His vision, at least at that time, was that the brand had the permission to go to other categories. And everyone originally was pushing energy, energy, energy. Mm. You know, his statement to me and to the board was really like, look, iced tea is an old category. It's really boring. And did you know how much sugar is in an Arizona iced tea? I mean, it is a lot of sugar. So it's a really bad for you category generally that has very boring brands. So what if we did something different and fun and cool? It turns out he was right. And the iced tea sector for us has been going really, really
well.
And
it's smart not to go into energy because, I mean, energy drinks can be dangerous. And the fun of Liquid Death is it's literally water and the safest liquid there is.
Yeah, and good for you relative to all the other beverages out there. So a healthier for you beverage with a really cool brand. I'm happy to be in that sector, yeah.
You are also in the underwear sector with Me Undies.
That's right, we did Me Undies. I mean, this is a long time ago.
Right.
10, 12 years ago, we helped get Me Undies off the ground.
Why? I mean, the underwear is underwear.
You know, I remember as a kid that there was a brand growing up that had these patterned underwear.
Oh my God,
Tommy Bob, something Tommy. Box, Joe Boxer. Was
okay,
it Joe
yeah,
Boxers?
Joe Boxer, yeah.
And it kind of went through a phase and these guys came in and again, like they had a vision for printed underwear and they happened to have what they considered the most comfortable fabric out there. And they launched this underwear brand and they really understood kind of this. I remember one of their first images were like these like, you know, super cool looking kids riding a bike, black and white shot in Brooklyn in their underwear, guys and girls just having fun. And they had this very specific vibe they captured. And it felt like that was going to be a moment. And so they were right. They caught a big audience and MeUndies got pretty big. We sold our position in MeUndies through kind of a big request of the company because they were kind of doing a recap. We ended up being fine and super happy with the outcome. But I really believe in the brand and I still wear the product every day.
And there's similarities between that and liquid death in the sense that here's a product that is it's just a functional product. It's water. It's underwear. You haven't changed the technology of it, but it's more the attitude in the branding.
That's right.
And I mean, the quality can be good, yeah.
But I mean, there's certain products in your life where when you use them, when you eat them, you wear them, whatever, they make you feel better about yourself. But there's a lot of products in your life that don't make you feel anything. They might even make you feel worse about yourself, you know? And so there's areas where brands can come in and actually make that human experience a little bit better and help kind of build up your identity and your confidence and what you're excited about. And there's a lot of products our days that don't do that. Like when I put on my standard white socks that I buy from Amazon, I don't feel any better about myself, you know? Maybe when I put on my cool patterned MeUndies, maybe I feel a little bit cooler than I did before, you know? So I think there's areas of this consumer experience and everyday products that we can make you feel a little bit better about yourself.
You have an involvement with pray.com. Are you going to disrupt the prayer?
They are disrupting the prayer, believe it or not.
How do you disrupt the prayer?
They originally came to us and said, hey, you know, we focus at Science. We really like areas where we create fans, not just consumers, but fans, where they love the brand.
Dollar Shave Club
fans, right? A lot of fans. In faith, there's a lot of fans.
Yeah.
Right? Just to be honest, like, you know, Jesus has a lot of followers. They're a very passionate fan group. And so they came to us and said, look, we think churches are struggling. We think the small church may or may not be around, you know, in the future. Mega churches are obviously growing. And be great if we could do two things. One is we could build a direct-to-consumer experience where, similar to those meditation apps, you could really connect with prayer. And the second is, could we build tools to facilitate these small churches to stay existence and actually talk to their congregations and build up their profile of their influencers, which are really their pastors and priests and ministers, et cetera. And so they built a pretty broad platform. And there's a SaaS component that works with faith organizations. There's a subscription component that's a direct-to-consumer application that brings faith to people's phones every day. There's a media component around podcasts and content. And they've built a heck of a media company all through this theme of prayer. And although there are very kind of, you know, Christian-focused broadly and Catholic-focused, they are expanding and they see themselves as this big platform. So it's been a really fun journey.
Well, and I think young pastors in particular are understanding that, you know, that the church service or what the church does have a customer.
Yeah.
And it does have, you know, I've been to services in which, as working in television production for so long, I've thought to myself, okay, now we should have shortened that just a little bit. So, you know, that the reason you're losing young people is attention span. It's, are you serving your audience in the right way? And there's nothing sacrilegious about that.
Nope. You're exactly right. I mean, they are a media entity, right? And just as all media entities, they started very fragmented and very local. And it's all becoming consolidated, right? I mean, that's just media. But I remember meeting early days with these kind of younger pastors who would say, oh, you know, one of them said this thing to me. He said, you know, I meet my kids and my congregation kind of where they are. I'm like, what does that mean? He's like, well, you know, I'll go play Fortnite with my kids and I'll talk to them and I'll hear about their days and I'll hear about challenges they're having and offer guidance however I can. And I think that's really true for a lot of what we look at as investors with consumers. You need to meet them where they are. So if your congregation's on Instagram, if they're on Facebook, if they're using podcasts, you need to be there for them. You can't force them every day or once a week to drive down to your local location and consume media in that position. So pray.com puts faith where people are and they consume it on a higher frequency basis than they did before. And again, it makes them feel better about themselves.
Is there a product like water, underwear, prayer that you've thought about? You know, like somebody ought to be disrupting. You mentioned white socks, something along those lines.
Yeah, there's... We think that way consistently. I think there's areas where we think, oh, it'd be great to do something here, but then we realize it's a really small market, really hard to do, very few exits. One of the interesting things is through this trip I did last week with Walmart and this group called The Platform, we went to Bentonville. And I don't know the last time you walked through a Walmart, but it's been a long time for me, right? Yeah. And remember, they're within 10 minutes. Most 90% of America are sitting within 10 minutes of a Walmart. And the volume and scale upon which they touch Americans' lives is hard to comprehend, to be honest. And so we walked the aisles of a Walmart with a former head merchandiser, as well as a team that basically works putting products on the shelves. And there's areas where I'm like, oh my gosh, this looks so boring and old. And they're like, let me tell you why this is a terrible place for you to spend time. And they walk me through the economics of it. They walk me through the competition, the innovation, or the lack of innovation. Yet there's other areas where I'd be like, what about here? They're like, oh my gosh, we would love someone to build something new here. People want new products here, but then no one's building anything because it's run by old sleepy businesses. So to your point, yes, we look at lots of different areas where we think, why don't we build something interesting here? We look for areas that are high frequency. So if we do something great and we create that fan, they can touch that product or consume that media or engage with that service more than once a week, preferably, and that often has really good exit. So we have a lens that we go through and we find little areas that we become interested in.
Your model is different than just writing the check, right? You
That's
are
right.
not just sitting in a boardroom, entrepreneur comes in.
Yeah.
You say, yeah, here's $50 million.
That's right.
Tell me how you're handling it.
So we run a studio. It means we're kind of like a movie producer in a weird way, right? In that, yeah, we cut the check, but we also become very engaged within the operations of the business and we have a greater than normal relationship with that founder. So some founders would go as far to call us co-founders. We rarely call ourselves co-founders, but at times we kind of function as that silent partner that comes in. We have an 18-person team that basically works hand in hand with those companies and those founders, help develop their vision, and we stay involved for a very long period of time. So I'm not interested in getting updated on a board meeting. I'm interested in talking to them once a day, once a week, understand the progress of the company. In many companies, we get daily visibility into the business. So we come in as an operational partner.
Sandhill Road will be right back. One of the interesting bits of trivia about you is that you were a CEO of MySpace.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
I almost feel like, to some people, we have to explain what MySpace was.
You still do. It's pretty funny, right? If I meet an 18-year-old or I'm talking at a high school, they have no reference for what MySpace is. So it is funny.
I will tell you a brief story, and I've told this story on this podcast before. Is when Friendster first launched, I was invited by Jonathan Abrams to come see his little project.
Yeah.
And it took me a minute. You know, he said, okay, so you've got a page with your picture on it, and then there's links to your friends.
Yeah.
And they have pages with their friends on it.
That's
and
right.
Once I got it, I thought, I had to explain social networking on television, you know, right? Yeah, it was hard, you know.
Yeah.
Once I got it, I was absolutely blown away by it. MySpace, it kind of went Friendster and then MySpace and then obviously Facebook.
That's right.
You took over it at MySpace as Facebook was on the ascent.
That's right.
Why? That seems
really
like a terrible deal.
I mean, so yeah, basically News Corp had acquired MySpace.
Yeah, for a lot of money. A
lot of money. Well, I mean— $580 million.
Yeah.
So was it a lot of money? I mean, in today's dollars, you're like, oh my God, isn't that like a C round? Anyway, so they'd acquired it for some amount of money, right? They realized they had a challenge. And they'd also injected a lot of News Corp energy into the business, for better or for worse, right? A really hyper focus on growth. And it happened to be that the head of News Corp Digital wanted to put in a new team. And so he reached out to me and he's a gentleman named John Miller who had bought one of my companies when he ran AOL. So he and I had a history. In a certain sense, he kind of made me, right? Because one of my second company I'd started, he bought it for a large sum of money, really showed me the process. And so I learned a lot from John and he called me up and said, look, you know, I want to bring in a new team to run MySpace. And I remember I had another mentor who I called and his name was Scott. And Scott said, you definitely should not do this. It is going to be the worst job you've ever taken on. You will learn the most you've ever been able to learn in business. You will become an expert and master of business, but this will be a terrible decision. I really recommend you don't do it. And you know, I do consider myself a student of business, and I was living in LA. I had young children at the time. I realized I wasn't going to be moving to the Bay Area. There were not very many big digital jobs in LA. I had been running a small private equity portfolio, and I thought, you know, if there's a time in my life I can go do something crazy like this and really learn, this is really it. And it ended up being the greatest learning experience of my business career, absolutely. It was an incredible journey. It was incredibly difficult. It was painful. It was exciting. It was everything. And obviously, in the end, Facebook continued to dominate the landscape as they continued to do. And we sold off MySpace essentially for parts in order to recover value for News Corp at the conclusion of my time there. I would never trade the experience for anything, but to your point, very, very hard journey.
And by understanding that Facebook was what it was going to be, you were reasonably successful. No, you did not overtake Facebook. And,
yep.
and yes, they sold it for parts. But all in all, I think you can consider your time at MySpace to be a reasonable success.
Yeah, and I think it was, I mean, you have to remember, to your point, you know, I had met with Friendster at the same period of time probably you met with them. And before that, there was this service called Six Degrees.
Oh, yeah.
Right, which was even before that. And it was something like, I looked at the data, it was like Six Degrees got to 1 million people, Friendster got to 10 million, MySpace got to 100 million, and then Facebook broke 1 billion. Now, there's a point to those stairs, right? And those steps that people took. You got to remember when I took over MySpace, people still were not putting in their real names
yes.
on a website. You were still nervous about using a credit card. You know, your mom was still calling you about viruses and unplugging lamps from the wall because they were worried. Like there was a general disbelief around this revealing personal identity online. And at the end of the day, of course, a social network is going to be better if you know your friends and you know more friends if you put in your real identity and yes. your location. And at the end of the day, MySpace had, and people, literally users of MySpace would refer them to as their internet friends. Oh, my internet friends are yes. on MySpace. When Facebook came out, oh, those are my friends.
My friends.
Right? Well, yeah. of course that's more powerful. And what I found that felt very true, and it was during the same time that Yahoo was going through its kind of identity crisis rebrand, what I found was if the DNA of MySpace was it was built on fantasy fake identities, the reality of me changing that to being a true identity platform with a true social graph, that really wasn't going to happen. And I think that's true for many businesses. You know, there's a DNA when people start these companies. And if you come in late and you try to change that DNA, it's pretty darn hard.
The one exception, I think, would be Snapchat. Because Snapchat was sort of thought as a sexed app
that's
for
true.
Very long. And they've been able to get away from that.
That's true. Well, you're assuming that a substantial portion of the Snapchat content is not still nude photos.
Touche, yes.
Maybe they've repressed it. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, all these services are our dating sites. Like, let's be honest. Like, MySpace, Facebook, yeah. Friendster, you know, these are dating platforms, really. I mean, there's a communication component, absolutely. Yeah. But I mean, when you're talking about social networking, you're talking a little bit about dating.
Yeah.
And if somebody's, and I think Snapchat, you know, found that same world, they just happen to hit during a different form and different time and a different audience, and they become highly relevant. I mean, Snapchat's an incredible platform.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Ever a temptation to be one of the guys, first friend on, was it Tom?
Tom.
Yes.
You know, I did not.
And you're like, it's Mike.
It's Mike. You know, replace Tom with Mike and we'll do it. I think it's so funny. I think early days, they built that social graph on the back of Tom's profile, which is one of the reasons why mechanically he was kind of at the center of the MySpace graph. And I think we realized that was a flaw in the engineering system or that they needed to upgrade that. And so they eventually removed that. But Tom became quite a personality, didn't he? Right? Like, that name is kind of infamous at this point. And he still is out in the world. He posts content on social. I bump into him every once in a while. Pretty incredible. Pretty incredible.
One of the silly things that you were remembering, people not using their real name, et cetera, that we would do in the media that just drove me crazy is, you know, there'd be a bunch of teenagers would have a party. Something would go wrong.
Yeah.
Police are called, et cetera. And we would say, and it was organized and they learned about it. On MySpace. As if that were relevant.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to they learned about it through the telephone. You know?
Right.
relevance.
I remember those stories. People's MySpace, is MySpace dangerous for teenagers?
Exactly.
So, yes.
Are just teenagers talking to each other
exactly.
and organizing really bad ideas dangerous.
It's very true.
You mentioned you were in LA. Someone said of LA's proximity to Silicon Valley, it's like going to college within a day's drive of your parents' house. You can go home and do laundry when you want or stay away when you want.
Who said that?
It's not
quote.
In my notes. I'll
I
have
like
to look
that.
It up.
I mean, LA is it's, I used to be in these media calls where they're like, is LA the next Silicon Valley?
Right.
My name is no, never. Like they will never be the next Silicon Valley. I mean, there is such a powerhouse here and the DNA of this area of the world is so incredible as it relates to technology and innovation. But if you're creating brands and you're thinking about culture and you're thinking about consumer, LA is a great place to
yes.
be.
You once said that I would love to see my 21-year-old self pitch my current self.
That's right.
What would you tell 20? How would you brief 21-year-old you to pitch you? What advice would you give?
You know, Well, I think if you're talking about pitching specifically, pitching's about, you know, a clear, concise message, broadcasting confidence, showing your passion within your area. I have no idea if I even had those things back then. But I think if I was talking to my 21-year-old self, I would definitely push for, you know, bigger dreams, bigger aspirations, bigger goals. You know, I think I think my first entrepreneurship venture, the question was, can I build something that I'll be able to pay my own salary? You know, yeah. Can I pay my own salary? And then it was like, can I build a company that can pay me a bigger salary and a bonus? Then it's like, and you kind of walk through those steps. I was not that kid that was like, I'm going to be a billionaire when I'm X year. Like, I didn't have this financial goal. I think originally I wanted independence. I was hard-headed and I just didn't want to work for anybody. And so I started my own companies. But I think if I was going back to my 20-year-old self, I'd say, set some bigger goals. Like, you can do those things. Now let's think bigger.
What's bigger? I mean, you know, you're involved in a number of very successful companies. What's bigger?
Well, you know, the companies I'm involved in, which I 100% love, they do, because venture capital naturally has a specific time horizon, yeah. Right? So I'm taking on problems that are a 4 to 10 year solution, either profitable and sold, you know, obviously not unprofitable and sold, or just going out of business, right? So there's a specific time horizon. You know, I think there's no mistaking the fact that Elon Musk today is redefining entrepreneurship, and they're thinking in decades, if not centuries, right? And I think there's a certain limitation to just traditional venture that caps what you work on because you're thinking about this time lens. Bigger for me would be bigger problems that take longer time periods to solve, and that's really intriguing for someone like me, you know, versus thinking on very short time windows.
Is that something you can go do?
It's something I might do. I won't do it now. I think under the science construct, especially when fast-moving CPG, our stuff is designed to be rapid and get to scale rapidly and find its path to exit rapidly. But at some point, like there's a, you know, I think I have my last child is in high school now, and 3 more years he'll go off to college, and then my time commitment will change, and at that point maybe there'll be a shift in the type of projects I like to spend time on.
What advice would you give somebody who is in consumer, who wants to be in consumer packaged goods, who is inventing that next iced tea or is inventing that next whatever it is, candy bar or whatever it happens to be? What's something to watch out for, something to know?
Well, I think what to watch out for is there are definitely areas that there's a ton of innovation and you don't need to go into those sectors, right? So, you know, and again, I'd highly recommend walk into a local grocery store and go to the area that you think you want to build something. And if it's not boring, then you probably shouldn't build there. So, you know, if you go to the energy section right now of a grocery store.
It's huge.
It's huge. And it's actually pretty exciting. Like there's new stuff to grab and cool labels and different looking cans and different value propositions. Like every time I go there, I'm pretty excited. Like I can grab fun stuff. But there's definitely areas you go to that are boring. So first thing I'd say is if there's an area where there's limited shelf space and high competition, I don't know if you really want to go spend time there. That's pretty darn hard, right? The second piece is, yes, you need a better for you product. That kind of goes without saying. I mean, microplastics sound like they're our new devil. Processed food sounds like we're all going to do a takedown there. I think we're past the keto movement, I suspect, but I think that low carb stays around. So there's trends you can piggyback on, create that better for you product. Absolutely. That's actually not hard. But finding that brand that connects to people and creates that polarizing moment where some people hate it, some people love it, that's hard to do. And so we see a lot of products that are good. Like we're doing a deal right now with a company that has a great product. They're selling $500,000 a month worth of product. We're very excited about them. Their brand is terrible. And the first thing, you're like, once that paperwork's signed, we're going to have a big sit down and be like, guys, we're going to talk about the name. We're going to talk about the brand because it's completely garbage. And we need something incredible here. And you got to push to find that incredible moment. If you don't find it, you know, you might generate some sales, but will you have a breakout? I don't know.
Yeah, and when the liquid death guy says, you know, I got a better brand name for you, I'll listen.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. And he'll be on call for them, actually. Right? Yeah. So I'll hope he'll help them out.
And lastly, has anyone told you you remind people a bit of Ryan Reynolds?
Oh my gosh, that is so, I have heard that actually. It's pretty funny. I'm definitely not as handsome, but I have no hair. So you know, I'm completely bald at this point. And I would never compare myself, but other people have mentioned that. Thank you. It's a comparison I'm happy to take.
It was meant as a compliment.
Yeah.
Those are my questions for you.
Beautiful.
Let me hit stop.
Easy.
On the thing. Yeah, it was fun. Mike Jones of Science Inc. Sandhill Road is produced by Sean Myers under the leadership of Sarah Bueno and Stephanie Adruni. For more interviews with Silicon Valley's most influential entrepreneurs, check me out on TV at Press Here. That's Sunday mornings on NBC Bay Area and everywhere in the world on iTunes and at PressHereTV.com.